The U.S. Congress has already been on their Thanksgiving break. Despite that, the political rancor continues. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Ben Kiefer. Western powers found apparent agreement over the weekend in Geneva in negotiations with Iran to halt their nuclear program. We'll discuss what the deal means for the Obama administration, what Congress might do on their own, and what it means to the U.S.'s relationship with Israel. From that nuclear discussion, we'll turn to a so-called nuclear option that Senate Democrats have pursued to aid the approval of judicial nominations. Our analysts today are Wayne Morier of Grinnell College and Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa. Join us for Politics Day after the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day today on the program, our weekly discussion of what's going on in politics, and there's plenty to talk about despite the Congress being on their Thanksgiving break. Our political analyst today, Wayne Morier, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, and Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Thank you both for being here.
Welcome.
It's a real pleasure.
Well, glad to have you on the program, and you can join our conversation by calling us at 866-780-9100. That's 866-780-9100. Send us an email at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also post on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Well, over the weekend in Geneva, a collection of Western nations came to what's called a temporary agreement for Iran to halt its nuclear program for 6 months. It's the first time in about 30 years that Iran has agreed to back off on its slow, steady progress toward having a nuclear weapon. And President Obama on Saturday announced that agreement.
We approach these negotiations with a basic understanding. Iran, like any nation, should be able to access peaceful nuclear energy. But because of its record of violating its obligations, Iran must accept strict limitations on its nuclear program that make it impossible to develop a nuclear weapon. In these negotiations, nothing will be agreed to unless everything is agreed to. The burden is on Iran to prove to the world that its nuclear program will be exclusively for peaceful purposes. If Iran seizes this opportunity, the Iranian people will benefit from rejoining the international community, and we can begin to chip away at the mistrust between our two nations. This would provide Iran with a dignified path to forge a new beginning with the wider world based on mutual respect. If, on the other hand, Iran refuses, it will face growing pressure and isolation.
The deal was weeks in the making and met with skepticism from others in the region, particularly Israel, which has a particular interest. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was sharp in his criticism of that deal.
What was concluded in Geneva last night is not a historic agreement. It's a historic mistake. It's not made the world a safer place. Like the agreement with North Korea in 2005, this agreement has made the world a much more dangerous place. I know that many share the concern of Israel, especially in the region, and there's a reason for this. For years, the international community has demanded that Iran cease all uranium enrichment. Now, for the first time, the international community has formally consented that Iran continue its enrichment of uranium. And this is in direct contravention of UN Security Council resolutions. Iran is taking only cosmetic steps, which it could reverse easily within a few weeks. And in return, sanctions that took years to put in place are going to be eased.
Again, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking there. And reminding us about that 2005 agreement with North Korea. And Wayne Morier, why don't we start with you? And what about that comparison with that North Korean agreement? What are the similarities?
Well, I don't think that the similarities are very great. What's at issue here is how long it will take Iran to make a bomb. North Korea already has a bomb. And what this agreement is trying to do is to delay the length of time that it will take Iran to make a bomb. Iran already has sufficient quantities of enriched nuclear material that it could conceivably make a bomb. This is uranium that's been enriched to a level of 25%. Only one part of natural uranium is fissionable, and you have to take that part and concentrate it through centrifuges to make it truly fissionable. But once it is at 25%, it can be easily taken to 90%, which allows you to make a bomb. And one of the things that this agreement does is force Iran to take the uranium that's enriched to 25% and to dilute it. Now, it could be reconstituted and make a bomb, but that will take time. And so the argument for the agreement is that it, in fact, will delay Iran's ability to make a bomb.
Does it, though, allow Iran to do other things? For example, we can't just have a bomb. We have to have it put on something. Or are they developing that? Is that part of what they would still be able to do?
Well, inspections are increased. And International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors are allowed to go anywhere that they want in the country. And so if Iran does decide to go for a bomb, the evidence is it hasn't decided to actually make a bomb yet, our chances of detecting it, at least this is the argument for the agreement, will be increased.
Well, some of the skepticism about the agreement has been that, well, we have a long history of a relationship with Iran, and that plays a part, as maybe it would with North Korea as well. Remind us a bit of the history with Iran and what whether that should factor into how skeptical we are.
Well, I think the skepticism is warranted, and it goes way back to the revolution and then the taking of American hostages. And Iran has been lying about its nuclear program from the beginning. I think the sanctions have worked. And I think the situation now is that the regime itself feels so pressured by the sanctions that it wants to make an agreement. This agreement is only a first step. And it's sort of it's a chance to test Iran. And in hopes of reaching a more comprehensive agreement later, and if there's any evidence that Iran is cheating, then this agreement can be reversed. So this is just a chance to see if Iran is really sincere at this stage in being willing to cut back its nuclear program.
Well, and the skepticism we've heard hasn't just been people in this country, but as we heard earlier, that clip from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Wayne Moyer, what of his reaction? It's a historic mistake, he says.
Well, I understand Netanyahu's reaction, and Israel's much closer to Iran, and so it has greater fear of Iranian nuclear weapons than the United States does. And I think in some senses, Netanyahu's skepticism is a good thing because it strengthens the bargaining position to go to the next step of the essentially a Security Council members plus Germany that are negotiating with Iran, and makes it more credible that if Iran doesn't comply, that it faces the possibility of military action.
Tim Hagel?
Well, I would say two things about that. The first is that, as Wayne was pointing out, that if this is a test, that it basically we can see if Iran is willing to cooperate and so forth. The problem with that, in the view of some at least, is that it basically eases up the sanctions on Iran and gives them the opportunity to perhaps push ahead before additional sanctions are put in place. And then the second problem is that some are also arguing that having lifted the sanctions, it will be nearly impossible to reinstate them again. And so it just basically is going to allow Iran to, again, sort of speed up whatever they're doing, again, have to hide it from the atomic energy inspectors. But well, I'm hesitating because there's just so many things going on with this, and it's just hard to say. And many people are so sort of suggesting, oh, well, we'll have to wait and see, but they're not doing so with much hope.
A lot of things going on with it, including a reaction to people in Congress, and we've heard some reactions there. What about politically for the Obama administration? What does it mean, Tim Hagel?
Well, it could mean a couple of things. On the one hand, they would like to say this is a success. Right now, the Obama administration is looking for some good news. They've had such a difficult time with Obamacare, and certainly some have suggested that things like this agreement are a way to distract from the negative news. That may or may not be the case. Certainly, this is something that they've apparently been working on for some time, so the timing may be purely coincidental, although some people would argue nothing's a coincidence in politics, so take that as you will. On the other hand, if we've got 6 months down the road and we'll sort of see where we're at, if Iran is found to be cheating or doesn't seem like this has been a successful agreement, that it comes kind of in the middle of we get into the campaign season. And right now, Democrats, even though Obama's not on the ballot for the midterm elections, but many Democrats who maybe had supported him in various ways are going to have perhaps to another bit of negative news to deal with if this isn't successful. If it is, then maybe they can again focus on that as a success for the administration rather than some of the negative things.
We want to open up to the phone lines in a few minutes. You can join our conversation. What do you think about this deal on Iran's nuclear program? Is it important? Is it a first step, or is it something that is a distraction and not going to be successful? What do you think? 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100, or post on our Facebook page. That's Iowa Public Radio. Wayne Moyer, what about the political implications here down the road? 6 months from now, as Tim Hagel suggests, we will be talking a lot about midterm elections in 2014, that following fall. And depending on how this turns out, how might it play out politically?
Well, I very much agree with Tim's analysis on this one. It all depends on what happens. If this agreement doesn't work, and Iran continues to escalate its program, the pressures for military action are going to increase considerably, because up until now, Iran's been increasing its capacity very, very rapidly. The numbers of centrifuges, the amount of this 25% enriched uranium that it has. And if that isn't stopped, I think the pressures on President Obama to use military force will be, and the Iranians don't keep this agreement, will be very high. And then that raises the question, if the president does use military force in a campaign season, whether that helps the Democrats or whether that hurts the Democrats. And one has to see this in the light of having two wars, more or less, in the Middle East, that we're out of one and still in Afghanistan. We're out of Iraq. And so that could well play into the election, too.
Tim Hagel, did you want to follow up there?
No, that's absolutely right. That of course, President Obama has vowed to get out of both Iraq and Afghanistan, out of one, trying to get out of the other, but it would still look bad if he were forced to take military action, although I'm not sure that he would. It might very well be that he would wait for Israel to do something, and then we would have to deal with a follow-up in one way or another, which is not necessarily a good option either.
And at some point, I guess we would think about Obama being a wartime president. The country's been at war his entire presidency, and if he were to start something new or be involved in a new conflict, that might shape his presidency a little differently.
It would, and I can't imagine that it would, again, be helpful to him. If this happens before the 2014 elections, that it would, I have to imagine, be very dispiriting to the Democratic base, which is already not particularly happy given a variety of things. And so that's going to be a big question in terms of turnout for 2014. If it happens after those elections going into 2016, it's probably going to have a significant effect on that particular race, regardless of who the candidates are.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. See if we can go to Dave in Des Moines. Dave, go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm always fascinated that when we talk about the historical ramifications of dealing with Iran, it kind of stops at the hostages, and it doesn't take into account that the CIA deposed the only democratically elected president, Mossadegh, who was in Iran. We replaced him with the Shah, who, by all accounts, was just a horrible dictator who tortured his own people. So, yeah, we're distrustful of the Iranians for good reason, but they have every right to be distrustful of us. And I think in order for us to move toward a peaceful, more peaceful planet and not have more weapons deployed, we have to kind of get over our own sense of self and understand where we fit into the Middle Eastern environment. Thanks. I'll take I'll go.
Okay. Thank you, Dave, for that question and comment. Wayne Moyer?
Well, the hostage situation, I think, still has an impact on all of us and has an impact on the policy process. And it's one of the things that's made it very difficult for anybody in the U.S. government of any administration to really trust Iran.
Again, this is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. We are joined by Wayne Moyer from Grinnell College and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa talking about politics and Iran in this portion of the program. You can call us at 866-780-9100. And let's go to Matt. He's calling from Cedar Rapids. Matt.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking
just fine.
My call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say that I think it's a huge mistake, and I agree with the Prime Minister of Israel in the sense that, you know, we do need to do something with Iran. We do need to stop their nuclear program, but we kind of caved in to what they were looking for. And to me, it seems like we're doing the same exact thing that we did do with North Korea. You know, albeit I don't think Iran's leader is quite as, you know, radical as North Korea's leader by any means. But, you know, we made this deal with them where, you know, they said, yeah, you can come in and inspect our country and take the uranium and then ease the sanctions, and that goes into effect right away versus, you know, making Iran prove to us that they're really serious. And it just seems to me that, you know, Mr. Kerry and Mr. Obama are all of a sudden trusting Iran after 30 years of deceit, stalling, and lies to the United States.
Okay, Matt, thank you for that call. A few points there. One thing, mentioning the new leader of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, is he different than the previous administration, or are we seeing the same thing? Do we know yet? Wayne Moyer.
Well, he looks somewhat different. He's, on the other hand, he's part of the Iranian establishment. But I think what's different is the domestic, economic, and political context in Iran. Iran is clearly hurt very badly by these sanctions. And there are enormous pressures developing within the country. And so I think the leadership is under a kind of pressure from inside the country that it has not been up until now. And that kind of pressure, I think, may well be helpful and may well augur favorably for this agreement.
Going back to this deal and how it's playing out domestically, there was a Reuters poll that showed that Americans approve of the deal by a 2-to-1 margin. Unclear maybe at what extent there people being polled understand the ins and outs of the deal, but still, again, the way it's playing out for the perception of the Obama administration is that 2-to-1 margin. What of that, Tim Hagel?
Well, you know, I saw that a headline on that. I didn't see any of the details as to far it was asked, and it surprised me that it would be that lopsided, given particularly the number of people, including many Democrats, who've come out and expressed concerns about this particular thing. And it may be that they were looking at it in terms of, well, okay, this is the next step, and basically took the position or agreed with the basic analysis that you saw. If you were watching Saturday Night like I was when the president and then Secretary Kerry were giving their speeches, you know, this is the next step. But there are a number of people that disagree with that. So I would think that maybe people aren't as clear on the details. And, you know, a lot of folks just, like I said, are just kind of have to wait and see whether it's successful, what the details are, and even within Iran. And today they were talking about how apparently the Iranians are not happy with the fact sheet or whatever that means in terms of what the United States put out about the deal, because they thought it was a great success. Now, that may have just been political posturing on their part to sell it to their people. But on the other hand, we still have to see if you know what the details are and what it really means 6 months down the road.
Let's go to Jim in Waterloo. Jim, go ahead.
Hey, hi, guys. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
Hey, just a couple things. One is, I think, and I'm very cautious about I guess, any diplomatic deal, so to speak, with Iran for a lot of the reasons that one of your guests has pointed out. That since the Iranian Revolution, you know, they really have not been a working partner with the rest of the world. I think there's some risk not only to America but to kind of stability in the region by letting Israel feel maybe like they're standing on an island by themselves. They've proven over and over again, you know, their threats are real and not perceived, and they're not afraid to take action, you know, where they feel that the threat has, you know, has been validated through their intelligence. So I think, you know, making deals and making decisions without a strong bias toward Israel is almost inviting some kind of calamity. The other comment is, it just seems like this really has the markings of a destabilizing deal for the region. You know, we backed the regime change in Egypt, and we backed regime change in Libya. We lucked out of backing regime change in Syria, and all of those states are, at least the two that we did back, are chaotic. They're anything but orderly and organized. And the cutting off of foreign aid to Egypt really has put the Egyptians kind of in the pocket or closer to the pocket of the Soviets. So I just think the Iran deal has a more of a destabilizing effect at this point in time.
Okay, Jim, thank you for your call. Wayne Moyer, destabilizing?
I think that's arguable. There's no question that Iran is not a status quo power, that it has ambitions and in the Middle East to strengthen its influence. If we have hurt them enough that we can now staunch their nuclear program, we may hold back. We may cause them to restrain their ambitions. But they're not to be trusted, and we have to continue to work with Israel in terms of trying to achieve understanding to the extent that we can.
Very good. And let's see if we can just take one more call. Zach in Cedar Falls, quickly.
Hey, one of your guests a minute ago was talking about posturing, at least on the part of Iran. I was curious if maybe there might be some posturing on the part of Israel, too, that nobody wants to make the deal look too good for Israel, or the Iranians might not sign. Do you think there's any chance that Netanyahu is maybe overplaying his hand in order to help the rest of us get some kind of deal? I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay, very good. Who wants to take that one?
Let me just say, the Iranian people are taking what Netanyahu is saying as a great victory for them. That they have in fact won these negotiations. Netanyahu says they're so bad that then the Iranians can say this is a glorious victory for us. I think that's a misconception.
Tim Hagel?
Yeah, just quickly that it's apparently the Israelis have walked back a little bit of their language, so I'm not sure how much it was posturing. But, you know, there's always a little bit of spin going on here playing the other side. But I still think that the other caller was correct in the sense that we do have to be careful not to let Israel feel that it's too isolated, because then it may end up taking action on its own without working with us.
Okay, Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Also with us, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Our guest will stay with us. We'll take a quick break and talk more about domestic politics in the second half of the program, including change to the rules of the Senate for filibustering judicial nominees. That's coming up, and you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. That's 866-780-9100. River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. Back in just a few minutes. Glad you're with us on our Politics Day on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton in for Ben Kiefer. Our guests for this Politics Day, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, and Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. And we're also taking your calls, your comments and questions. We have domestic issues on the agenda for the first part of this half hour. 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can email us, river2river@iowapublicradio.org, tweet us at IPR Talk, post on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Well, Senate Democrats voted to change the Senate rules so that judicial appointments cannot be filibustered. It only takes now 51 votes to end the debate for those nominees. And last week, an effort led by Majority Leader Harry Reid, the Senate voted 52-48 to eliminate the filibuster on those nominations. The minority will no longer be able to block judicial nominees in that way, except to the Supreme Court. Iowa's Democratic Senator Tom Harkin was a strong proponent of changing Senate rules to prevent filibuster on those nominations. He says, quote, "This has been escalating for a long period of time, and it was time to stop it, and that's what we did this morning. Now we need to take it a step farther and change the filibuster rules on legislation." Tom Harkin there stands in contrast, though, with what he had to say in 2005 when Republicans were threatening to make the same rule change to allow approval of their judicial nominations.
Mr. President, I am very pleased to hear about the bipartisan agreement that preserves minority rights in the Senate, that preserves the right of the minority to extended debate, that preserves the checks and balances that our founding fathers prized so highly. My hope now is that after weeks of distraction, after weeks during which the majority leader threatened the nuclear option to sort of blow up the Senate, now that we hopefully we can return to the people's business. I want to thank the 14 senators, I guess 7 Democrats and 7 Republicans, who worked so hard to kind of bring us back from the brink and get us away from this nuclear option that really would have destroyed the smooth functioning of the Senate. But we've been talking for weeks and weeks about this nuclear option. Well, Mr. President, Iowans that I talked to have been absolutely astonished that the Senate has been distracted by these nuclear option threats. They keep asking me, why haven't we been addressing the real concerns that keep Americans up at night, worrying about their jobs, their health care, and their family's future? Why is the Senate spending its time on this narrow ideological agenda and ignoring the people's business?
Likewise, Iowa's Republican Senator Chuck Grassley was very critical of the recent Senate rule change. In a speech on the Senate floor, he called the move, quote, "a complete and total power grab." But in 2005, when his party was pushing for the same rule change, the option was not being called nuclear. It was being called constitutional.
The Democrats are denying the Senate its constitutional responsibility of advice and consent by systematically denying appellate court nominees an up or down vote. And we can't find anywheres in the Constitution that says a supermajority is needed for confirmation. So it's now up to us to restore the traditions of the Senate, stopping abuse of power. For more than 200 years, senators agreed that the proper way to oppose a judicial nominee is for a yes or no vote, up or down. They went to the floor then to explain why they opposed the nominee if they opposed him. Then they voted against the nominee. They did not filibuster. What's the harm of giving nominees an up or down vote? It's fair to everybody. It applies to everybody, Republicans and Democrats alike. So let's have some common decency, constitutional courtesy, to grant these qualified nominees an up or down vote. That's all we ask of the other party. The constitutional option is a way of restoring the long-standing Senate traditions, traditions that have stood beside and will continue to stand beside, traditions that are fair, traditions that show respect for the rule of law. I took an oath to uphold the Constitution. That's why I'm supporting the constitutional option.
Again, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley there in 2005 with a slightly different perspective on the filibuster. So who's right? Is it a power grab, constitutional option, a distraction from the people's business? Tim Hagel.
All the above. Well, here's the thing that starting with Senator Grassley, he's right in the sense that the Constitution doesn't require a supermajority for this type of vote. But on the other hand, the Senate has long had some form of rule on this type since people have thrown out the figure 225 years, basically since the beginning of the Senate, essentially. It's changed a little bit over time. In fact, it used to be that it was two-thirds vote that was required, and then they lowered that to 60 votes to end the debate. And the idea was is to differentiate the Senate from the House, to be the place that's, I think the phrase that some have used is the cooling saucer of debate and the people's business. So, and Senator Grassley's right that especially for judicial nominations, it had long been that they would come up for a vote, that the filibuster really wasn't used that much. And then in the Bush administration in 2005 and so forth, the Democrats started using a strategy of using filibusters to keep Court of Appeals nominations from going forward to get that up or down vote. And that's what, of course, Senator Grassley and other Republicans at the time were so concerned about and were threatening the nuclear option, which, of course, was avoided. A gang of 14, seven Democrats and seven Republicans came together, cut a deal, and things went forward. And then when the power shifted in the Senate and the Democrats had control, then the Republicans used their ability to filibuster to prevent what they thought were a number of nominees from reaching Court of Appeals, which is essentially what's going on here, where you had a number of Obama nominees that were appointed in particular to the D.C. Court of Appeals that Republicans thought were too ideological. And undoubtedly a certain amount of just forestalling Obama's nominations in general. And so this is why one reason why the Democrats decided to actually exercise the nuclear option. So there is some shoes on the other foot disease going on here. But on the other hand, I'm a person that's generally in favor of keeping the filibuster, as annoying it is if you're the party that it's being used against. I think it still has a certain value, but at a certain point it does become a distraction. And for the Democrats, it had reached that point. For the Republicans, they hadn't.
Wayne Moyer, go ahead.
Let me just add a little to that. I think this is almost an inevitable consequence of the polarization in Washington. That the two parties are so far apart it would have been hard, I think, to maintain the filibuster because the filibuster was not only blocking the choices of both Democratic and Republican administrations to the courts, but also to government positions. I think one positive consequence of this will be that whoever is president will be able to get the people that he or she wants in his or her cabinet and sub-cabinet position. The negative will be we're likely to see ideologically divided courts, the Republicans likely to appoint ideological Republicans and Democrats leftist ideological people to the court, and that the courts themselves will be very divided over time ideologically.
But how different would it be then if this is a first step towards changing filibuster rules on legislation and perhaps Supreme Court nominations?
My guess is now that once you've started, it'll be hard to preserve the filibuster for anything. I don't know whether Tim would agree with that.
I think that's true, and many people have commented on that. And, of course, we heard Senator Harkins say exactly that he wants to get rid of it for legislation. And you can think of times when the filibuster has been used to hold up what people generally think of as good legislation, like the Civil Rights Act. But on the other hand, there are times when perhaps it's not a bad thing to hold up some legislation that may be ill-advised or may not be as protective of minority rights, depending on whatever minority you're talking about, as could otherwise be the case, unless you get what would normally be some type of bipartisan support, which is what 60 votes in the Senate would ordinarily give you. Or if your party actually has 60 senators, then it has perhaps seen as having enough supermajority support that people in the minority would go along with it. But I would think that we're probably going to see the filibuster go away in other areas as well, including the U.S. Supreme Court.
866-780-9100. You can call us 866-780-9100. And let's go to Ed in Robbins.
Yes, my question is, why has neither party ever suggested taking the supermajority rules and the rules about filibuster and raising them in the Senate to a level of a constitutional rule rather than an operating rule of the U.S. Senate? And I'll take my answer off the phone.
Okay, thank you, Ed, for that call.
There are a number of aspects in the Constitution where a supermajority is required, things like proposing amendments, of course, and also impeaching various officers, and actually the conviction on the impeachment. But I don't know why people haven't really talked about, perhaps because at least until now, that rule hasn't been – the filibuster rule hasn't been seriously threatened, and it seemed to be kind of a good thing to have. Now, of course, right now, and as Wayne was saying, with the strong ideological divide in the Senate, it may be that it was time for the rule to – be modified or to be gotten rid of. We'll have to see if there's comes a time in the future when people are willing to put it back in place. I know a couple of people have suggested that if the Republicans are so concerned about the demise of the of this rule, they can put it back in place when they're in power. And yeah, that's not going to happen. So we'll just kind of have to wait and see at this point.
Yeah, and Senator Grassley has said the silver lining of the situation is that when Republicans eventually control the Senate once again, they can change the rules to approve Supreme Court nominations or some other changes with a simple majority vote. So. Let's see if we can go back to the phone lines in a moment. You can call us at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. And briefly, before we get to another topic, not that we need to focus on the 2014 midterm elections quite yet, but they will be here soon enough. Does a move like this play out politically during the campaign season, or is it something that will get pushed aside?
Now, this is pretty much inside baseball at this point. I think that it could have an effect if some big nomination comes up between now and next summer or early fall where the filibuster rule would have had an effect and then some particular candidate wants to make an issue of it. But for the most part, it's just a process question and people, by and large, aren't going to care too much about it.
Wayne Moyer?
If for some reason we were to lose a Supreme Court justice before the election and Obama was to make an appointment, I assume that the Republicans would be staunchly opposed to almost anybody that Obama appointed. And then the pressure would be to remove it for Supreme Court justices, and I could see how that might play out politically.
And President Obama has made two nominations to the Supreme Court so far.
He's made two. The one that people are sort of looking at is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who has suggested earlier that she wanted to stay on the court till she was 80. Well, that she's reached that point, but she's also suggested she wants to stay on a little bit longer. And if there seems to be a threat that the Republicans would actually take over the Senate, then maybe she would be willing to retire at the end of this term, which would be June of 2014. On the other hand, the justices don't like to retire during an election year, so we'll have to wait and see.
This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News, and glad you can be with us today. You can call us at 866-780-9100. We're changing topics now. We're going to talk a little bit about some news this week. The Treasury Department and the IRS have proposed new rules defining what political activity is and how much money can be spent on it by certain tax-exempt groups. It covers TV ads and get-out-the-vote efforts. And this is vaguely related to the Citizens United case from 2010. What does this mean? What's your understanding of what this change is? Tim Hagel.
Well, essentially, especially since Citizens United, that Democrats in particular have been very upset with this decision because they see it as giving corporations and big money donors a way to fund a lot of money into politics. And with this particular regulation, it has to deal more with particular groups that, again, would allow big money donors to anonymously give to the groups to engage in a variety of activities, a certain percentage of which can be political, but the majority of which still needs to be social, educational, something of that nature.
Or half of it anyway.
At least half of it, something like that. So it's basically, in the view of the administration, the IRS, is a way to dampen down what they see as a way for donors on the right to fund political campaigns. The thing is that it applies to all groups. And so you would have groups on the left that would be affected too in various ways. And sometimes they don't always realize that, you know, it applies to everybody in one way or another. And even if this regulation goes into place, place that a lot of times the folks can find another way to get their money out there to become part of the political process.
But aren't right-wing conservative groups more prominent in using these organizations as opposed to maybe labor unions or maybe more lean on the Democratic side, and labor unions wouldn't be affected?
Groups on both sides have a way of finding the ability to support their candidates, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, left or right, however you want to characterize it. So, yeah, the perception is that those on the right have used this technique, these groups, to their advantage a little bit more. So in that sense, you can see this as more or less a cynical political move. And in fact, today I was listening to one particular person who's involved in this, and the head of one of these groups was suggesting that this is basically a way to try to dampen down the free speech efforts of these particular groups, and that the IRS should be the referee in this, not one of the players.
Wayne Moyer.
Well, I think part of it is the vagueness of congressional legislation, and my guess is that this thing is going to take a long time to play out and will be contested. But in the courts, I suspect that Tim is right, though, that groups on both sides are going to find ways to get whatever money they have into political campaigns.
Very good. Well, the Supreme Court justices agreed this week to review provisions in the Affordable Care Act requiring employers of a certain size to offer insurance coverage for birth control and other reproductive health services. At issue is whether private companies can refuse to do so on the basis that it violates religious beliefs. So companies that refuse to provide the coverage could be fined up to $1.3 million daily. Oral arguments will likely be held in March with a ruling in late June. Tim Hagel, is there anything we can draw upon to give us a hint about what the Supreme Court might view this issue at, how they might approach it?
Well, there are two cases that are combined that have come up, and the two circuit courts, courts of appeals, the 10th Circuit and the 3rd Circuit, came to different conclusions as to whether this mandate was appropriate. And one, of course, involves Hobby Lobby, and I can't remember how to pronounce the name of the woodworking company out of Pennsylvania. But there are a couple of interesting twists to this. It's not just a matter of the companies saying that because of our religious beliefs, both companies are family-held businesses, that because of our religious beliefs, we don't want to provide – it's not so much birth control. It's more a matter of the particular medicines involved would be able to perform abortions, a Plan B and so forth. And that's the thing that really is concerning to them. But the twist in all of this is the question as to whether a corporation, like a person, has that free exercise of religion, that constitutional right. And the corporations, courts have held that the corporations have free speech rights. So the next question is, well, do they also have free exercise of religion rights? And so that's what complicates this particular case a bit, because the justices could decide to go one way on the religious liberty for individuals question, but say, but not, doesn't apply to corporations. So we may get, there may be some hint to this if you were to look at the Court of Appeals decisions, but we may not know the particular direction that the companies are going to argue and the government's going to argue until they have their oral arguments in March.
And beyond religious rights, there's a lot of rights that are applied to people that it might seem odd or awkward to apply to a corporation.
Right. Well, to quote some famous person, corporations are people. I'm quoting Romney, of course. But as a lawyer, I would say that they are. They are treated as an entity, a legal entity, maybe not necessarily as a person per se, but they are treated as a legal entity. And the question then is, how far do you push that analogy in the legal world?
Go ahead, Wayne Moyer. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me just add that the trend seems to be going in the direction of looking at corporations more and more as individuals. I mean, the Citizens United case, and my suspicion is that there's at least a good likelihood that the court will go that way in this case.
Again, this is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. Our guests today, Wayne Moyer from Grinnell College and Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa. We just have a few minutes remaining, gentlemen. I thought maybe we could, before we end the program, return briefly to the subject of Iran, but more specifically, Secretary of State John Kerry, who was the architect of that Iran deal that was announced over the weekend. His first, I suppose, major diplomatic accomplishment since taking the post earlier this year. He addressed people over the weekend about that issue. But again, Kerry, not quite a year into his service as Secretary of State, can we say anything at this point about what his style is or his approach? Wayne Moyer, what do you think?
Well, I think that he's taken on a very ambitious agenda. He's near the end of his career. He's thinking legacy. I'm sure he's wanted to be Secretary of State for a long time. He's got a lot of experience with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee earlier. He's not going to run for office again. He's clearly willing to take risks. You've got the Palestinian-Israeli talks. You have the Iran talks. He's been very active in Afghanistan. We don't know yet what's going to come out of it, but he's clearly been willing to take risks. And I think I can say this honestly, that his predecessor, Hillary Clinton, was not willing to take.
Tim Hagel.
Yeah, and given President Obama's management style, which tends to be a little more hands-off, that it gives Kerry, I suppose, that ability to take those risks that maybe will result in success, maybe not. We'll have to wait and see at this point. As we were saying before, that the agreement gave around 6 months, and if things seem to be progressing well, then it would be a feather in Kerry's cap, and if not, then it could be very bad for him in terms of legacy.
Okay, very good. Well, Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, thank you for being on our program today.
You're welcome.
And Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, thank you also.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Well, River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. The executive producer of talk shows is Catherine Perkins, also assistance from Dennis Reese. Theme music composed and performed by the River Monks. If you have a suggestion for a show idea, if you'd like to comment on a program you've heard, you can email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, and for Ben Kiefer, who's back in the studio on Monday, have a happy Thanksgiving.